Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at technology today, the technology we're likely to see in the coming year, everything from more streaming services to home appliances connected to the internet. Do you need your washing machine or your dryer connected to the internet? Probably you could do it. Well, I'll find out as we talk with a couple of guests. Jesse LeGrew, back with us. He's the information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Works with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. Jesse, good to see you again.
It's good to see you too.
And I'm really pleased to welcome Beth Wendt, a senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. She's with us for the first time. She brings 20 years of experience and a love for creative problem solving. Beth, good to see you as well.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
So as you listen to these two experts talk, what questions do you have about maybe about future technology? Is there something you're looking forward to? Is there something you're confused about? Maybe you're having a tech problem. We can deal with those as well. Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Beth, it's your first time with us today. Tell us a little about your background and why you like working in technology.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on, Larry. It's really good to be here. This is my first time on the radio, so new experience. Technology is a field that has given me the opportunity to learn something new every day. And that's something I love. Keeps me always learning, always researching, always reaching for new knowledge and new skill sets. There, every single day are problems that come my way that I may have never seen before. And it really requires me to think on the fly. And I, you know, love to solve problems and find creative solutions for people to help them get their work done.
And you've been doing it for 20 years.
20 years, yeah.
That's a long time.
It is.
That's almost as long as Jesse doing it. So as I'll ask you both this, but I'll start with you. What are some of your favorite technologies of the past year? Anything new? Or maybe this last, or even go back to the last decade?
I would say at least in the last year, some of the advances that have been made in home security systems I think have been really pretty remarkable as far as connecting people with their homes when they're not there so that they can not only monitor what's going on in and around their home when they're not there, but also control a lot of the systems within their homes, like the heat and air conditioning, opening and closing of doors.
Turning
the lights on and off, things like that, where we used to have to use a lot of analog technologies or, you know, have a neighbor stop by while you're out of town and flip on your lights so that people wouldn't think that you were out of town. And I think many of those advancements in the last year have really made some of those systems much more accessible and easier to use for folks who aren't necessarily into technology.
Yeah, I'm not fully I'm invested in it. I just haven't done it all yet. I guess we can put it that way. But I have a couple of friends who say, oh, it's so nice on the way home. They get the temperature turned up in the house so that it's nicer when they get there and things like that, Jesse.
Yeah, well, I definitely like home automation. Home automation is always, it's always a lot of fun, which I think in the coming year we're going to see a lot more of. One item that I'm very interested in seeing a lot more is kind of augmented reality, virtual reality, not just in a day-to-day kind of entertainment sphere. I do like video games, and it you can see it mature over time, but also for education, teaching and learning. There's a lot of cool technologies coming out that allow for a more immersive experience that otherwise you wouldn't really have. So let's say you want to operate on something and learn about anatomy. It's not something you may get the opportunity to do in real life, and augmented reality allows you to interact with something in a way that you can learn something from and do it in a more safe way and actually get feedback. So it's really cool to see how we can use a lot of those technologies for entertainment, but also for kind of expanding our own horizons and learning.
You know, you think back the last decade, here we are, a lot of people now have purchased smartphones, of course, joined social media. Just think about the last 10 years. Tablets, like the iPad, have become very popular. What do you think of when you think of the last 10 years in tech?
I probably think a lot of mobile devices. I think even when I got my first cell phone, which was probably about 20 years ago, it was, you know, a flip phone. You kind of had the internet on it. You can do a few things. But in the last 10 years, I think we've seen a dramatic change, not in only how much it's been adopted on a day-to-day basis, but how it impacts our daily lives. And I can see it wherever I am. If I'm walking down the hallway and just see people glued to their screens, unfortunately, I also see that on the road. But it's something that we've definitely seen kind of a societal impact in how we interact with our technology and how we change our interactions with people around us. And those mobile devices have just changed a lot. And I think we've seen that in smart homes, other technologies that are here to come, of we want to be connected to everything. We want to know everything that's going on, and we want to have a better grasp and control of our environment.
I was thinking back to the first time I ever did a show on technology, this sort of technology, and we were, I remember talking about my daughter's Commodore PET. how that has changed from all that, 30 years, 25, 30 years ago. That's what we were talking about then. It just absolutely boggles my mind.
About 15 years ago, I worked for a company in the area that was also attached to a cellular phone company. So they had some of those newer technologies coming through the organization and had an opportunity to go to an internal demonstration where they brought in one of the very first smartphones that was ever made. So this was back in 2004, 2005. And started talking about what the future was going to look like 10, 15 years, 20 years down the road. And it was, this was back when Palm Pilots were really the big thing, mm-hmm. but they weren't connected to anything. there was, you know, it was like a little handheld calendar that maybe buzzed in your pocket to tell you when you had a meeting, but it didn't actually interact with anything else in the world. And they brought in this first prototype smartphone and showed us what that looked like and with the touchscreen technology that they were coming up with. And then we talked about the future. And it was this visioning session where we learned that all of our music, all of our video, all of our data, everything was going to come through this little device in the next 10 to 15 years. And we're all looking at this thinking, really? I mean, are we really in the future yet? But I look, you know, over the last 15 years, it's come to fruition. And now we have this device in our back pocket that is more powerful than the computers that landed people on the moon in the late 60s. So it's pretty incredible where we've come from.
So looking forward now, it sounds like we're going to be seeing more of some of the things that we're all, you know, that have already been introduced. A lot of people have smart speakers, Amazon's Alexa or Google Home already. But now we're talking more and more about making the home smart, as you were talking about. I mentioned, perhaps facetiously, having your washing machine or your dryer hooked up. That really a possibility?
In some cases, it already is. And I think that's one of the items we're going to see more and more, not only for these, you know, what they call the IoT, or Internet of Things devices that are just connecting to allow you to interface with your smoker to make sure you get the perfect ribs, or you are in a healthcare facility utilizing sensors that are connected to allow you to perform better diagnosis, or something using artificial intelligence in the cloud to take that data and actually to help with diagnosis or other items. So, and this is part of that big 5G network that everyone keeps talking about. We're going to have a lot greater speed, lower latency, and allowing for a lot of these either at home or in the industry or in healthcare, but devices that are going to be able to be a little bit more interconnected, to be able to communicate to each other and to work a little bit more efficiently that kind of also includes like the driving cars. So self-driving cars will be able to communicate and help to tell each other, am I in your way? How is everything moving? So it gives these devices better awareness of kind of what's around them. And I think that wireless growth also changes all the devices that could utilize that technology. That includes smart homes and all these many, many other devices.
So the 5G is really basically it's just a speeding up of everything?
It's a lot faster. And it's lower latency. So a lot of times when you have to communicate with a service, and people know this if they've used other wireless technologies in the past, the further away you are, the longer it takes to kind of get a conversation going back and forth. So with 5G, it allows that conversation to happen a little bit quicker, so you don't notice that pause between statement one and statement two or that reply. And so that allows these devices to talk a little bit more real time, and you can actually get a little bit more real time feedback, which is why you can use it for a self-driving car, because you need that real time responsiveness.
Yeah. Beth, yeah. What are the worries associated with it? Or do you have worries?
Worries with 5G or worry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think people need to keep in mind a few things about 5G. One thing is really all 5G means is that this is the fifth generation of cellular data technology. So now we are in a new class of technology that is emerging into the markets. Generally, when those new technologies emerge, when you start hearing those new buzzwords, which maybe about a year and a half ago, we started hearing about 5G, it takes maybe 2, 3, 4 years for that technology actually to catch up to where consumers can take advantage of it. So my cautions would be around think about what you're actually getting for what service providers are going to be charging for it. Are you really going to be getting something better than what you already have? And 5G is still pretty immature as far as the infrastructure that's out there. It's also a little bit confusing because there are three different types of 5G currently. So people don't know what to purchase if they're offered multiple plans. They don't understand the differences between them. So I think once the 5G technology becomes more mature, it certainly is going to, like Jesse said, drive a lot of the devices that we're using to be more communicative with each other. So I think that the availability of 5G is going to change what we see in those types of Internet of Things devices. Those are going to grow and mature, but not until 5G is a little bit more widely available and accessible to consumers.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Well, let's take some calls. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jeff in Superior up now. Jeff, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Years ago, I used to be a hired hand milking cows on dairy farms in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And I know that they talked about this technology where there was a chip around the cow's collar, and it would walk up and be milked, and then the feed would be dispensed based on the individual cow's needs or the nutrition requirements. I wondered if there's research or if there has been research to actually apply that to, say, it's going to sound weird, but I know there's ethical questions, but like to people in prisons, maybe they need certain medications or certain nutrition therapy, and that after their prison sentence, they'd actually be a more wholesome, better human being. Has there ever done research that's like that?
That is interesting. Actually, for a time, I did work for the Department of Corrections, so I've got a little bit of experience with some of the monitoring technologies that have been used on inmates within the system. At the point that I was working in it, all of it was really location-based tracking to try to figure out where people were and keep an eye on them. But I could certainly see some of those same technologies that are used for, tracking animals, livestock, other things that you need to keep track of being applied to people in general, not just the inmate population, but Jesse talked a little bit about healthcare, wearable devices that allow a provider, either a veterinarian for animals or, you know, a medical clinic within a facility, or just your family doctor to see how you're doing and to catch things maybe before you even know about them.
Yeah. Jesse, anything to add on that?
Well, and I think that's one of the items that's really coming out this year, too, is the use of more wearables, not only just for health and fitness, but also for, I don't want to say augmented reality, but utilizing earbuds that actually allow you to pick up more sounds. So you can actually use them as a hearing aid device in addition to the normal streaming and primary uses that we kind of consider today. And even looking at the collars for these cows, it's actually really an extension of that kind of technology. It's trying to understand kind of what's happening to the cow itself in terms of temperature changes, heart rate, everything else. And from that information, understand, well, is it digesting food? Is it sleeping? Is it not? Mm. Is it stressed? And I think that could be utilized a variety of ways. I've seen it in like wellness campaigns for people to better understand, you know, how they react to situations. It can also be used for just general health. But in especially in prisons or corrections, a lot of things might happen that you might not want to happen. So it can allow you to track individuals in a way to make sure they are healthy and that things are you know, happening that you anticipate. And with the cows, that's one extension of understanding, like, do they need food? Am I seeing something that is an indicator of that? But you can, you know, bridge that out to anything. And these new devices actually have capabilities that normally you'd have to go to a doctor for. And now you're actually able to do that at home or anywhere else you are with some of these devices that they even talked about at the Consumer Electronics Show. And so it's very interesting how that's expanding. I didn't actually hear about the cow thing, but it makes sense. If I could make sure that my dog's okay at home, why maybe I want to do that. I mean, I have a chip to make sure I can identify the dog, but maybe I do want to make sure that he's happy and healthy, and if something happens, I can have an automated response or just know that I get an alert to do something.
Really cool stuff. Jesse LeGrew with us and Beth Wendt. Jesse is Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Beth Wendt has worked in IT for 20 years. She's Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. It loves to find creative solutions to problems. And certainly we can talk about problems if you have some technical issues you want to discuss. Of course, we're zeroed in so far a little bit on new technology trends and innovations. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at technology on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Jesse LeGrew from Madison College, Beth Wendt from the Division of Information Technology at UW-Madison. Great to have them with us. Questions or comments for them, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Dave and Racine will give you a chance now. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, everybody. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I appreciate your show. Here's my thinking, and I'm curious what your guests think on this tech, which is a really great show. We discovered years ago that there's a technology in existence, software, that you can prevent a driver of a vehicle from using that cell phone for texting or calling if the vehicle rolls more than 3 miles an hour or anything above that. And what that means is the passengers in the vehicle can use their cell phone, the driver cannot. Now, I also understand that the reason that's not adopted is, you know, big telecom stops it at the state capital levels with the typical campaign contributions. I'm just curious what they've heard of that or what they think of it at this point.
Huh. All right. Well, Beth, you want to start?
Well, I know there are actually several pieces of, well, apps, you would call them, pieces of software, things you can download for your phone that will stop you from texting or calling while you're driving. A couple of those applications that are already out there on the market, AT&T has one called Drive Mode. There's also another one called OMW or On My Way. One more called It Can Wait. These are all apps that you can download through either the App Store or Google Play, or depending on what platform your phone is. I think most of them are free. And you can set it up in a way that it will disable certain functions of your phone while you're moving, like you said. They're things that you have to self-select, though. You have to choose to put this on your phone and choose to make your phone or your driving situation safer. It's not something that you know, the phone manufacturer is going to put on there for you, or that's going to be mandated by any kind of regulation. So this is really a I want to be a safer driver. I want to stop having the urge to text or to call while I have, you know, while I'm driving, while I have my phone on me. So this is a piece of software that I can put on here that will not allow me to do that while I'm driving, and it'll stop those urges. Or something maybe you could put on your kid's phone, you know, if they're a new driver and you're worried about the texting and driving. It's an application that you could use to help with some peace of mind there.
That's a good idea. I've got a 16-year-old daughter who will soon have a driver's license, probably in the next 6 months or so, and that's a real good consideration for me. And I, frankly, I try and turn the phone off just so that there's not the temptation.
Yep, and I think that's probably one of the use cases that's going to be more common, just like any other kind of software to like filter web content or ensure a safe browsing experience for a child. This would be something that, hey, if you have the cell phone and you also want to drive, we're going to install the software, and they do have it out there, so you can actually monitor that use while they're using it. I think one of the challenges to really facilitate, how do we stop individuals from being able to use a phone while driving? Once again, as best stated, this is, you know, something you have to do yourself. There are a lot of challenges to be able to do that centrally. I mean, think about when you're a passenger in a vehicle. How do you deviate between or be able to discern you're a passenger versus a driver? And it's a lot more complicated. So more of it's a little bit more personal responsibility, in addition to if you have a parent or if you are a parent and have a child with a cell phone and they are driving, it's a consideration for them to have a safer driving experience and ensure that they don't pick up that habit of utilizing a cell phone while driving.
Thanks again, Dave. Appreciate it. Harry in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Harry.
Hey, Larry, I guess. Hey, I was just listening to you guys and the call about the guy saying, oh, you know, maybe we should be microchipping our prisoners. And geez, it just raised some huge alarm bells in my mind. In November, Frontline on PBS had a two-hour documentary on the effects of artificial intelligence and talking about how the Chinese are using face recognition and artificial intelligence. And I just think you guys need to talk about the downside of some of these technologies. I mean, 5G is going to also allow real-time surveillance. Really?
Yeah.
It's pretty worrisome, people.
Yeah, but privacy invading kinds of things. Well, let's start. Let's talk about that a little bit. Jesse, you want to start?
Yeah, I think this is another situation. Anything, any technology, any innovation that we put into the world, we have many uses for, either for the good or for the bad. It's not necessarily the technology itself that's good or bad. It's really in how we adopt it and how we utilize it in a day-to-day basis. And there are risks that come into play when thinking about all these devices working a little bit more efficiently in certain scenarios. Facial recognition is definitely one of those. We've seen deep fakes, for example, these fake videos where it can easily recreate somebody's face and potentially voice to make a false video, something that you didn't anticipate. And that similar technology you could also utilize for facial recognition. So there are a ton of risks, especially considering privacy. And, I mean, I walk around day to day in buildings with cameras, which I usually don't think about. There is so much data out there, video, audio, everything else. I mean, right now I'm on the radio. This is posted to a website. That audio is out there. To actually create a false audio of somebody else, you only need a couple seconds, and that's it. And
you need a few sentences, really, of them speaking, and then you can recreate their voice and say essentially whatever you want in their voice.
Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that brings up if we have devices that are constantly plugged into the internet with GPS location, if my smart car has a microphone because it wants to listen to my commands when I'm telling it to go somewhere else, is there a camera in there? Because maybe I'm using facial recognition as a security feature. All your personal data, all of a sudden, the conversations you're having in a smart car that's traveling all around, they know where you are, who you're with, what you're saying. And a lot of that we put in the onus of, you know, one, the consumer to make that decision, to put themselves in that situation. But also we ask a lot of these companies, what are you doing with my data? How are you sharing it? And can I really trust you? And we've seen a lot of concerns over the years from that kind of data sharing. So, I mean, the risks are there. We've seen them. People are going to find bad ways to use technology, and they're also going to find ways to get to data they shouldn't have access to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as for facial recognition specifically, that's a technology that's been pretty widely available within video surveillance systems for at least 10 years. So likely your face is already out there, saved on a database somewhere. And it's really the data already exists. What artificial intelligence brings to the fold now is the ability to process all of that data. Now, there is software that is now out, maybe not necessarily for the consumer market, but people have access to things that allow them to take all of that facial recognition data and create actual links between who these people are, what they look like, where they've been, what they buy, what they talk about, what they browse online, what kind of, laundry soap they purchase. All of that data then comes together, and the aggregation of that data, I think, is really where we need to be careful about who has access to it, who that data is sold to, how they use it, and to really be savvy with how we choose to let that data out into the world. But a lot of it, like facial recognition, it's already out there. Your face is in a database already.
Oh. Harry, thanks a lot for that question. I appreciate it very much. Sue in Eau Claire has something, too. So let's go there, and then Jose after that. Sue, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some other questions about the safety factors with going to the 5G stuff. There's a lot of us who already have problems with some of the EMF that comes off of computers, cell phones, any of the electronic devices. There's also some media coverage that's already been out there about 5G. I don't remember where I heard it was, but there were six college students who lived in one dormitory where a 5G device had been implanted on the some part of the dorm. And there's a new incidence of six cases of brain cancer. That's unheard of. I'm a neuroscience nurse, have been for a long, long time. I've not seen that kind of statistics. And I'm wondering, what are they doing to pay attention to some of the safety data that's been put out already about 5G?
And that's been a concern before 5G, let alone, I mean, you know, there's always been a lot of talk about, well, you're running around with a cell phone in your front pocket or your back pocket or whatever, and concerns relating to that. Beth?
The big concern, I would think, with specific to 5G is, so there's three different flavors of 5G, if you want to call it that. There's low band, mid band, and high band. High band is the one that is concerning, at least from a radiation or EMF standpoint, essentially, because 5G utilizes something called millimeter wave, which is very similar to microwave technology, essentially a microwave oven emitting radiation into the world. Thankfully, high-band 5G is pretty far off into the future before we'll see that really emerging in consumer markets. Hopefully, there will be more research done between now and when that actually starts to become implemented. but we don't really have the infrastructure in the U.S. to support it anywhere outside of very densely populated urban areas. So I think that's where we're going to see a lot of the research going, is in how that EMF, that electronic magnetic field radiation, impacts those densely populated urban areas.
So there's some research going, or is there?
There is research going on, specific to, you know, how the millimeter wave technology, how those kind of microwave pulses out into the air impact things like cellular biology and cellular mutation, things like that at the biological level. But I don't think there's much published out there yet. So I think as it matures, we'll get there.
But Sue has a right to be concerned and questioning, at least.
Certainly reading about it and keeping on top of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Sue, thank you for bringing that up. Appreciate it. By the way, you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jose in Wausau, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good to talk to you guys. I have a small seasonal business, and I just kind of emphasize the seasonal part of it. Just wondering, what do you think are the future of actually having a website? Because, you know, we use Google Business, and they have a little kind of a little informational area, a little what they actually call a website. You can put photos in your, you know, the hours that you're open. Use a little bit of Facebook for photos and kind of what's going on. But, you know, actually having a website, is that really, really that necessary for maybe a small business these days?
All right. Well, what do you think, Jesse?
I think, I mean, more and more I see information on Yelp, on Facebook. It's posted a variety of different ways. But I think for me, it always depends on what I'm looking for. What kind of business am I actually trying to get information from? So, you know, if you have a lot of questions by end users or future consumers out there, and they can't be answered simply by a Facebook ad or by a Facebook page, there might be a need for a website. But I think there's a variety of ways to utilize other technologies that are out there instead of purchasing a website domain and getting formal hosting to do that. I think there's so many different ways to do it. And having a traditional website isn't necessarily required, although I do think depending on what you're looking at, it might help. So, you know, if you are, for example, a video creation company, having something a little bit more elaborate to show samples might be useful. But although, you know, we have YouTube and lots of other services out there too that are completely free. So you can find ways, but I think it'll depend on business to business and what you're really looking for. I don't think Microsoft will ever get away from being able to have a website just due to the services that they offer. But some businesses, I don't think, really would require it.
So let's say, and I don't know what Jose's business is, but let's say he's sort of like a farmer's market kind of person. So he's got seasonally, he's got produce and whatnot to sell, but then he may not have it. Well, he doesn't have it perhaps in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if there are things, if you have a business where either what you're selling or the service that you're providing is dynamic, where things change and you want your customers to know what those changes are on a frequent basis, then I think a website that you could maintain and put new information on frequently would be a good way to go. But if your service or product is pretty static and people who are looking for somebody who sells or provides what you're selling or providing, and you just need your contact information to get in front of them when they're looking for that specific product or service, then using Google or Yelp or a Facebook page, those are very effective ways of it's kind of like the difference between putting an ad in the old Yellow Pages for somebody to know that you are a person who provides this product or service and putting up a billboard that has all of your stuff, your products listed, and a, you know, big fancy picture so that you're attracting attention to your business.
Yeah, and just going back to somebody like Jose whose business is that way, so you're saying maybe Yelp and some of the other Facebook,
mm-hmm.
may even be better ways to go, and getting your current customers in on that list somehow.
Well, your website, too, isn't going to show up when somebody does a Google search unless you pay for some search engine optimization as well. That's, you know, if somebody just searches for Jose's seasonal service, likely you're not going to show up on the first page of searched items if you have a website out there, because you're not paying, unless you're paying for search engine optimization, which can cost a significant amount of money. If you're using Facebook or you're using Yelp or you're using Google, it's going to go by location. So when somebody searches for Jose's seasonal service, it's going to know where they are in the world, and it's going to look for anyone who has that business in that area, and it's going to put that at the top of the list. So people are going to find you.
Yeah. Jose, does that help out?
Yeah, that helps a little bit. Yeah, it is an actual Christmas tree farm, the seasonal part of it. And the other thing is, with my current website, I've been told by the provider or the host that it's got an old format where it needs a new SSL certificate. So I'm just debating whether to go another step into recreating it or just kind of maybe saying, well, let's try a year just without it and see how it goes.
Yeah, and so websites definitely have a use, especially in being memorable, easy to find, because I can think of like Twitter as a good mechanism to tell people about updates, but people aren't going to remember twitter.com/whatever randomness that I have for you to access. And for the SSL cert, there are free options out there that can actually be automated, so you do have security on your website, and you don't necessarily have to pay a premium. And I think any website out there, I would state there's no reason for any of them not to have SSL, so you can have a secure connection, because once again, we're trying to do that to improve privacy for everyone, individuals navigating the website in addition to those that are hosting it. One that I am aware of is Let's Encrypt, and I would recommend taking a look at that, because it could be an option if you were concerned with the potential, you know, monthly or annual cost.
Hmm. What's it called again?
It's called Let's Encrypt.
Let's Encrypt. There we go. Jose, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, today. We're talking new technology trends and innovations, but we can also deal with those sort of problems that develop with your computer or with your software. Certainly look forward to hearing those types of questions as well. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at new innovations and technology trends with our two guests today, Jesse LeGru, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group, and Beth Wendt, worked in IT for nearly 20 years. She's a senior IT specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Questions for them, maybe about technology and innovations, maybe about a current problem that you're having. We certainly welcome those questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Adelaide in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Adelaide.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
So Beth earlier mentioned that 10, 15 years ago, she was shown a prototype of a smartphone and told this is what the world is going to look like in 10, 15 years. I was wondering if either of the guests had opinions or insight as far as what technology now is being developed that's going to make a difference in 10, 15 years.
All right.
Oh, most definitely flying cars. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. So, you know, when I thought about the year 2020, 20 years ago, it sounded like the future to me. So I expected things to look like the Jetsons. Thinking about 10, 15, 20 years from now, I'm not sure what that even looks like with the pace at which technology has been changing just over the last decade or so. But some of the things that, you know, I know are really going to become much more prevalent in our lives, things which make everyday tasks autonomous, things that take it out of your hands to have to do. So I think we're going to see more more machine learning and artificial intelligence built into at-home helpers, things like a Roomba that's been around for a while, maybe having some more intelligence built into it, being able to do not necessarily a Rosie the Robot like we saw in the Jetsons, but more technologies that allow us to forego some of the tedious tasks of life, like keeping our homes, driving our cars to work and back. I think automated vehicles are really going to become more prevalent, and far more technology built with artificial intelligence capabilities, machine learning capabilities, so that our machines are better able to interface with us as human beings, rather than, for the whole history of technology, human beings kind of adjusting to the technology.
Yeah. Jesse, anything to add there?
Well, interestingly enough, Uber Elevate is a service that I think Uber would like to get off the ground to allow for actually riding in flying vehicles, in addition to shipping packages and other things. So I think there's going to be a lot of changes with, I think, automation in general, home automation, being able to manicure the life around you based on all of these little inputs we have, in addition to our wearable devices, our homes. I think more and more artificial intelligence is going to be utilized to kind of manicure our surroundings based upon all the data that we give it. So if I go at home and my watch finds out that I'm really, really stressed out, my house is going to help me out on that one. And I think seeing that technology evolve, I think we're just going to see all these different technologies that are a little bit more independent. I think they're going to talk to each other more and more. There are obviously risks there because your life's kind of out there. I think privacy and how we think about it might also change over time in terms of what do we think of privacy as some people have grown up in this experience. They probably have a different take on how is my privacy being violated or not. So I think our ideas of privacy are probably going to change over time. But in addition, all of these nice little devices that we're using, they're not just going to be, a thermostat. That thermostat's going to be talking to a camera that I have in the hallway that's talking to the doorbell opener that's talking to my smartwatch. So everything will become increasingly automated as we use more and more of these technologies. And I think it's just going to expand quite a bit.
And I'm just thinking back, too, there's a compatibility thing. I know in December it was Amazon and Apple and Google kind of got together with a little truce there. They're working together on a standard, I believe, to help make smart home products compatible with one another.
And it's one of those things that's definitely needed. So many technologies that we get are proprietary. So you find out, hey, I want smart light bulbs. Well, I have this technology. What's the smart doorbell I can get? Okay, what's the smart this I can get? And you have to find all these specific products to work with each other. The idea of them getting in together and say, hey, we're going to create a standard so that they can talk to each other and the consumer doesn't have to worry about what service do I have to use. All these devices will collaborate and work together without them needing to be the same company or needing to be a particular brand. So I think it's going to be a huge improvement to the environment we can create with these different technologies. We don't have to worry about what's on the box and is it checking all the right things I need.
Yeah.
You can just pick it up and know it has the standard. It's going to work.
Oh, great. Adelaide, thanks again. I appreciate it very much. Well, Charles in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Charles.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling with a question that occurred to me after hearing you speak a little bit about some advancements in network, like 5G. But I was curious if your guest could talk a little bit about some advancements in database technology that have permitted companies like Netflix to track just trillions of user events every day. And I think I have that figure right. I'm pretty sure they're able to capture and process just somewhere in the ballpark of trillions of user events. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Beth, to start with you, maybe?
Yeah, certainly. The fact that the data has been there for a long time was pretty irrelevant until we had the computing power, the processing power, and the database power to use the data. And we're there now. So we're at a point where those trillions of data points that are coming in constantly are usable by companies, by governments. So advances in database technology that allow companies like Netflix to really process trillions of transactions at a time have really, I think, grown, one, because of the growth of some of the cloud services that are out there, offering larger aggregated database storage and computing to, you know, companies that maybe aren't even like a Netflix, but even smaller organizations that are able to now have much larger and wider processing and computing power than they did before because of these cloud services that offer them the infrastructure to do so. Not everyone has to have their own data center full of servers to be able to do that. You can spin something up through Amazon or through one of the other cloud providers and start capturing and processing data like this and use it for whatever purpose you'd like. So I think really some of those cloud services have been the trigger for a lot of the database advancements, allowing companies like Netflix and other, you know, larger companies that are processing so many transactions to capture all that data and start using it.
Yeah. Could I want to go back to kind of the Jose type person with a small business sitting in Eau Claire, let's say. Could that small business person say, find data for his or her market and use those data?
Oh, yeah. It used to be if you were a business owner or a salesperson, you would buy sales leads, right? Mm-hmm. And you would do that through a company that does market research or a PR firm, or you'd have to hire people to do that to get that information for you. Now you can reach out to a company like Cambridge Analytica and pay them a certain amount of money to provide you with data about very specific demographics of people. So it could be a neighborhood. It could be a city. It could be a street. You want to target some group of people? A company like Cambridge Analytica can do that for you. You want to target them, find out everything you possibly can about them, and then market to them. You have the tools and the resources to do that.
At a price.
At a price.
Yeah, at a price for sure. But maybe it's a price worth paying.
Really depends on what you're looking for.
Yeah. Well, Matthew in Stanley, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi.
Hello. Yes. Wondering with the new quantum fields that they're using, what advancements they'll have on solar technology, because you won't have to send a signal out anymore. You can send it into the quantum field right in the phone.
You guys familiar with that at all?
That's a little bit outside of my field of expertise. So, I'm not really there with quantum physics. I would go to Jesse. You got any knowledge to drop on this one?
I wish I did.
More research would be necessary, I think.
Well, yeah, well, it's interesting, though. Maybe something that we can look into and maybe make some comments on down the road. But for this moment, we can't help you out, Matthew. But
okay.
It's really interesting. Mike in Wauwatosa. Your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Lair. So I think what he was looking for was actually quantum encryption, just to maybe help you out on a future show.
Yeah.
But my question actually comes back to the self-driving cars. And because life happens and the world happens, there's still going to be accidents with self-driving cars. And I guess I'm not real too comfortable with, that there's going to be an algorithm determining whether I live or die, depending on which way my car swerves.
Yeah, and I definitely completely understand that, and I think no one also wants to make the decision in terms of liability, and I think that's one of the items that's come up. So if you do have a road and you have to turn left or right, you only have two choices, and either way it's going to cause a death. Which one do you choose? How do you make that decision? Who programs that and who's responsible for the decision that the vehicle makes based on the input of that operator? And it's a very complicated question. There's a lot of people really considering what does that look like. And it's a difficult position to be in. In the end, we're put in those positions as individuals, and we make those decisions. But it's very different when you feel like a company or a robot or a self-driving car is making that decision for you. What if it decides, for example, that the individual in front of you is actually more important than your life? So, these are real questions, and they have to be answered. And there's a lot of people sitting around thinking about this to understand how do we make that decision and what does that look like? Because I think there are a variety of ways to solve that challenge. But I think that's also where our own comfort lies in adopting or utilizing a technology. If we're not comfortable with it, we're not going to use it. But around us, that technology still exists.
We are talking today with Jesse LeGrew from Madison College's Technology Services Group and Beth Wen from the UW-Madison Division of Information Technology, visiting with them about technology trends and innovations and other things as well as we visit with them. We are going to take a quick look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. To have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests today. One, Jesse LeGrew, Information Security Architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Also, Beth Wendt, great to have her with us for the first time joining us. She's a Senior IT Specialist of UW-Madison's Division of Information Technologies. 20 years, roughly, of tech experience on Beth's part here. Talking about what technology we might see in 2020, maybe what would you like to see, or questions about the technology you have right now, give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And, we have Barry and Madison on the phone, so let's go to Barry next. Hi, Barry.
Hi there. Good afternoon. My question is simply, what do your guests project over the next 10 or 15 years in terms of the impact that this technology will have on low and middle skill level employees, and who should be responsible for the retraining, and how many of these people do you think is going to be affected?
Okay, Jesse, we can start with you.
Sure. So I largely have no idea how many people will be affected, although as we've been seeing, I mean, manufacturing for a long time has had increased automation. We've seen it for a very, very long time. We've also seen different trends at, for example, fast food, whether it's tellers that you're not communicating with, it's more machine-based and a little bit more automated. I think there's going to be changes over time in terms of what we're automating with machines and what individuals are actually doing, and seeing kind of a shift in the workforce. One of the things that I've seen even just locally, and I think this expands potentially even over across the country or worldwide, is that a lot of other traditional skills that we might have valued, let's say, 40 to 60 years ago are coming up a little bit more often. So when I was growing up, I was very focused, you know, technology is a thing, highly educated skills were a thing. And now I'm seeing a lot more of, well, you know, we don't have anyone that knows how to weld. A lot of the other skilled trades that we're actually seeing, we need more individuals to actually fill those roles that, you know, I think maybe 40 years ago were actually potentially being frowned upon and saying, don't do that, do this technology thing. So I think we're going to see a shift in kind of what individuals are looking at in terms of education. I think the question's already been up there in terms of higher education and questioning what is higher education needed for, and what does our future workforce look like? And a lot of those things are going to change. We are going to see more automation. We're going to see job shift. But I think some other traditional occupations we're probably going to see increase. So I think we'll still have people performing functions, but I think they're going to be doing different things in terms of how they're getting that education. I think definitely as a country or as a world, the means to get that education are going to be different based upon where you are. But having a re-educated workforce to be able to move somewhere and kind of pivot into a different career might be necessary.
Yeah. We were just talking about this last week on the program. As a matter of fact, I had someone from Madison College who actually is involved with instructions in a carpentry program, and we talked about the need for those kind of plumber, electrical, carpentry kinds of positions. Are they feel every graduate from Madison College walks right into is his or her choice of a lot of different possibilities. So there's probably going to be a lot of retraining, and I'm guessing that a lot of places, the tech colleges or the Madison colleges, as an example, are going to be sort of leading the forefront of perhaps of this kind of training. Who knows? Beth, you wanted to add too.
Yeah, I think from my standpoint, I do quite a bit of hiring within the technology sector. And throughout the years of doing that, I have been more inclined to hire someone with a 2-year technical education in network administration, systems administration, systems engineering, computer security, things like that, through a Madison College or another technical vocational school, because they actually come out of those programs with real world skills that they can use right away as soon as they are hired into the position, than taking somebody out of a 4-year CS program necessarily. Mm-hmm. The person who's going through the 4-year CS degree is learning a lot of theory, a lot of mathematics, maybe how to program. And those are not the only jobs that are available in technology. So, I would encourage folks to look into those 2-year associate degree technical vocational education options. They're certainly more accessible to the community at large, both financially and, they're just more of them out there. And I'll reiterate what Jesse said. We don't have enough plumbers. We don't have enough carpenters. We don't have enough electricians, auto mechanics, folks who can actually fix things and build things. Computers and robots will not be doing that for us in the next 10 or 15 years. We're just not there yet. We'll still need those skills. And there is really a dearth of that in the marketplace right now, and a lot of positions to be filled.
Barry, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Jim in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Jim.
Hey, listen, I've got a remote control for my television, and if the remote control breaks down, I can't do any manual work with the TV. There's no manual controls.
So, I understand what you're saying, Jim.
Yeah, there's no off button, right, on the TV itself? So if your battery runs out, you can't turn your TV off?
No, the battery's fine, but the remote doesn't work. And then I can't control the TV manually.
Yeah, they're not given many options for that other than buying a new remote. I mean, you could turn it off by unplugging it, but other than that, there's not much else you can do. Jesse, do you have a...
No, the only thing I could recommend taking a look at, a lot of the newer TVs, even though, you kind of have the remote dependence, they create buttons without them actually looking like buttons. So they're not the traditional, it's going to jut out, it's going to look like a box, and I'm going to be able to push it in. So it actually could be that there are buttons on the front of the TV that are actually completely flat, and they kind of seamlessly blend in, where you might actually be able to push on a certain section or touch a certain section of the TV and it might turn on. That would be my only recommendation to take a look at. Otherwise, you can also take a look at the manual. But obviously, you know, if you have no option but getting a new battery for the remote, that's an option. But usually I've seen most TVs have some kind of option, so you can manually turn it on or off or control it. And I would probably look for the manual to verify, but it actually could be there, and they made it so you can't see it.
Yeah, my Apple TV set has those buttons on the backside, on the lower right corner, more or less.
Where you can't find
like,
them.
Where, you know, I could feel them, and I've had to use them myself to correct some issues that I had with my own remote.
Yeah, there are also some smart TVs out there that allow you to download an app to your smartphone where you can control your TV from your smartphone. So if you do have one of the newer televisions that's come out in the last couple of years, it's a smart TV, often there will be an application that you can download so you can control it right from your cell phone instead of having to use that remote.
So there you go, Jim. Thank you for calling. Reggie in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Reggie.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
So I was just wondering with, you know, the advancements in technology and, you know, how small everything is getting, larger components like, you know, PC components, are we looking at those getting any less expensive, more available, things of that nature?
Mm-hmm.
I used to actually build PCs for folks, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. I'd buy parts separately in larger quantities, you know, buy a whole bunch of power supplies, buy a whole bunch of motherboards, and build computers for people as a little side business. And now I can't buy the parts and make one for any cheaper than you could go out and buy a new tower on Amazon or Newegg or any of the places out online where you can get one. So I don't see the components themselves coming down in price any more than they have, just because it's become so inexpensive to manufacture the whole computer.
Yeah, I think the only challenge with really anything that we make is resource availability. So at least one thing I've heard, depending on the materials used for motherboards or other integrated circuits, is if certain parts or certain materials are not available, either we will not be receiving those parts, or they will dramatically increase in price. Mm-hmm. I don't see them necessarily dropping any lower. I think the technology is getting less and less expensive, at least on a whole, maybe not on a component level. If anything, the price is probably going to be going up just due to the fact that as the scarcity of resources increases over time, it's a likelihood. But we'll kind of see where that goes. That depends also when we're getting our resources, where we're purchasing our chips, because many times it's usually overseas. And so if we ever have any changes there, that could impact things. But they could also just stay the same, and day to day we could see the same thing.
Oh, man. Reggie, thank you. Robert in Merrill, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me. It's been a good listen so far. I just want to bring up, I work for a local telecommunication company, so I kind of pay attention to the market a little bit. What I noticed over the last few years was actually Apple buying off a lot of augmented reality companies, which at first I kind of just thought was for the phone, until the last couple of years they've been patenting AR glasses technology. Rumor had it that they were supposed to release it this year and then pushed it back to 2-3 years because the device wasn't quite ready for consumers yet. But the real big push and what I'm seeing is I think that's going to be kind of the main avenue for, you know, bypassing or actually, you know, being the extension to your phone, to have a HUD up on your glasses for GPS so you don't have to look at your phone when answering calls through there, even having video up on the glasses themselves. There are other augmented reality companies over there right now who have actually said that they're holding back from releasing anything because they're waiting for Apple to come out there and really drop their stuff because they don't want to release their device to have another device from Apple release and then, you know, just kind of take over the sales on that. But I was just wondering if you guys had any information on that and what your thoughts are on the technology in general.
All right. Robert, thank you so much. Beth, you want to take a crack?
Sure, yeah. So this sounds a little bit like what Google Glass was supposed to be. So kind of a heads-up display right in front of your eyes so you're not actually having to hold a device or wear a device on your wrist. That would give you a heads-up display right in front of you so that you could process things like, I guess, like the Terminator did in those movies. I see some of that coming more into play, not maybe as much with the wearables, but I did hear anecdotally about something this weekend, which is interesting. And Jesse talked a little bit about this in the augmented reality field. There is an organization right now that is working with creating like a hologram room, which is a space you can go into where augmented reality is projected into the space. And that space can be used to train the individual to do things that they aren't able to train on in reality. Either it's too dangerous or they need kind of a safe practice zone, or the application I heard of anecdotally was to train older folks who are learning new medication regimens and self-care things, to walk them through an augmented reality version of their home. Instead of a person coming over to their house, they can do this in clinic. They can walk through, and the person can walk through every single step that that person's going to need to go through in order to be able to do this in reality. It's like a try it before you do it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Cool stuff.
Cool stuff.
Yeah, and they—if you actually look at Apple's website too—they actually have a full augmented reality portion of their website, and it looks like they're already trying to tout what you can do with an iPad or an iPhone. You know, we've seen this a lot of times where you can take a picture of your room and you want to buy some furniture, you want to see how it sits in there. That's one easy example, and that's actually one of the examples they even have on their website, is being able to kind of frame your existing house and move things around, and they have a full kit you can actually purchase. So if you're looking to develop for augmented reality, it kind of gives you a way in there, and they actually tout the App Store as well. So they already have some things that are allowing for augmented reality using existing products. The question will be, will they have something else in the future, like an Oculus that people are waiting for? Who knows? But it looks like, you know, when you have millions of devices out there, they already have something to utilize. It's really just software at that point. So there's some things already out there. I'm uncertain whether there's going to be other physical devices. But if they are, they at least weren't announced in CES last week, so maybe we're at least a year away or for the next announcement by Apple.
I sort of flashed on Star Trek.
Holodeck, right?
The holodeck in Star Trek, which I guess we're a ways away from that, but
I think that's the next thing after 4K TV, right? We all get a holodeck in our living room?
Oh, man. John in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. Wow, what a topic today. Been listening for a while, and kind of a couple of people called in about what you think maybe 10, 15 years from now is going to look like 20 years. And and I hope that with all these developments with social programs, and like your one guest said, it's not just a matter of turning your furnace on, but it's technology that can help you run your entire house. And those mundane things that technology seems to do for us now is, I honestly really don't care for any of it. Like your one caller said about the remote, there's so many things about technology these days that I think if we concentrate a little bit more on maybe finding some developing technology that could better utilize existing energy sources, or even maybe battery storage, or maybe anything but these mundane or social programs. I don't really care that if my refrigerator texts me and tells me there's 3 oranges in the fridge now instead of 5 that there were yesterday. I'm just not interested in that kind of technology these days. And I was just curious about, you know, what your guests think about that.
John, thank you. All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Well, and I think we see a lot of the consumer items that we interact with on a day-to-day basis. I think there are a lot of innovations that actually happen with the same technology. So especially when you think about healthcare, there's a variety of things that augmented reality could help. One for those that are actually in the healthcare industry and that are caring for individuals. But when we think about things like machine learning, taking all this data and making sense of it, we can actually see, instead of just improvements in our day-to-day mundane lives, we can actually see improvements in healthcare and other fields where we can utilize a lot of the same technologies in a different way. And I think that's one of the benefits we see. We have a lot of ways to use it for the good, for the bad, and for the mundane. But we will see different technologies used in different ways. And that's the nice thing with technologies. You can use it many different ways. Maybe somebody decided, I really want augmented reality because I want to be able to walk into a volcano. Sounds like a weird hobby, but it's an option. Well, somebody in a healthcare field could say, hey, I could use this and actually teach students about anatomy in a way that they've never been able to experience because we can't shrink people down and walk them through a circulatory system. Well, we can do that with augmented reality. Same technology utilized in a different way. And I think that's one of the benefits we have. We just tend to focus on those little pieces that we interact with on a day-to-day basis. I'm not necessarily concerned with anatomy on a day-to-day basis, although my daughter enjoys anatomy. So that would be something she would love to do. So I think similar technologies, we're going to see different advances, and it's going to impact more than at least, you know, the time when my that last piece of bread is gone.
Well, I just thinking back, you look at the space program, and some people wondered, why the heck are we spending all this money to get us to the moon, or as an example. But then you think of all of the benefits, the inventions, and everything that came as a result of that program that had really nothing, in a way, far surpassed what the program, the space program, was about.
Well, and a lot of what we see today in the consumer markets actually started off as research in military technologies, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So the theories behind the consumer technology that we see, those are only applicable because of the research that went into creating the broader scope of technology that enables those devices and softwares and digital ecosystems like a smart home. So I think looking at the progression of where things go, you kind of start with these more academic environments or research environments that have military applications or healthcare applications because that's where the funding and money comes from to do that research. Then it comes into the consumer market as something that we may see as kind of trivial. You know, that's maybe not necessary, but cool and makes your life a little bit easier. But then really smart people start taking those things and turning them into ways to make real change in the world, to utilize those consumer technologies or things that were originally, developed for military or healthcare and apply them towards something that has real world impact.
Great discussion today. I want to thank both of our guests today, Jesse LeGrew from Madison College and Beth Wendt from UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. The time flew by. I had a lot of fun. I'm really sorry we didn't get to all the questions, but that's generally how it works. But we'll have them both back, either singly or together, and we'll do it all over again. Oh, man. And if you'd like more about our guests or our show topics, just go to WPR.org/Larry and see what's up there. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.